You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this should be broadcast on the 5th of September, 2024. And the title that I initially had for this talk and the article that will go along with it is Debt, Fake Elections, and Ukraine's Failures. And then upon writing that, I realized that almost all of my broadcasts can be entitled Debt, Fake Elections, and Ukraine's Failures. So it's a little general, but today we're talking about a few distinct but clearly related sets of events. Because in one form or another, everything I talk about has to do with one of these three conceptions, at least on the Daily Nationalist, if not elsewhere. One thing that which has just been reported, and I got this from RT, which is quite relevant, the regime via the administration of the Weekend at Bernie's Joe Biden is going to resurrect the Russiagate claims. The administration, that is to say, the Attorney General, is planning on setting up a set of accusations with some legal nonsense accusing Russia, which is a very vague term, legally speaking, and what they consider meddling in these fake elections. Not only that, I mention the Attorney General because law enforcement action is going to be activated. Now, CNN reported this. But it may have been today, or yesterday at least, and it shouldn't shock anyone, that RT itself is going to be the main target of this action. Now, I don't believe that the regime thinks that there's going to be any legal consequences, because they've tried this nonsense before. The disconnect between the media's reporting and what their own friends in the regime, although in this case it would be the deep state, because these are mostly government actors, were doing was pretty substantial. What was being said in public and what was being said in much longer reports that no normal person is ever going to read, or, you know, the distinction is huge. If you remember, you know, it seems like yesterday we were talking about this, but for the 2016 election, which was also rigged, but Hillary was so unpopular that she couldn't even win a rigged election, it's going to be a little more difficult this time around than it was 4 years ago. But the exact quote is that, and they use the words like Kremlin and Russia, Putin, they use these interchangeably, which means it's not really a legal case, but they accused Russia of a sustained effort to influence the 2024 U.S. elections by using, quote, Kremlin-run media to spread disinformation. CNN claims to be citing government sources, and I can only assume that's either in intelligence or a press release from the Attorney General's office. They don't say one way or the other. But using these terms like Kremlin and and Russia interchangeably, or Kremlin-run media, which is, again, just projection as far as the Americans are concerned, that this is a sustained, and by sustained, I think they mean systematic, and that they are, that they're going to influence these elections. Now, back in 2016, the media was claiming that this was a hacking thing where they were actually altering voting results, which for the most part was not even the regime's accusation. But these people believe that influencing is spreading disinformation, which normally means facts and logic. And then they go on to say that law enforcement action is going to be utilized to target this covert Russian campaign. They stated clearly that Russia Today, or RT, is the main focus of this. CNN said that U.S. officials see the Russian outlet, that is RT, as a key piece of Kremlin propaganda efforts. And even terms like projection, terms like that don't capture what's really going on here. It suggests to me that they don't have a whole lot of faith in Kamala Harris, and you may be facing a 2016 situation where you will have substantial manipulation from the system that won't be sufficient. The general methods used and that have been used, both in off-year and presidential elections, is fairly well known, at least among people on the right, that it's not going to be as easy as it was. And it comes down to the truth of the matter is that the only people who are going to manipulate this election is the system, utilizing a few key Democratic-controlled cities, places like Atlanta or Philadelphia and Chicago, Los Angeles, to manipulate, or, you know, Columbus, big cities that they can use to shift important states' voting and hence their electoral count. Now, I've been reading and citing Russia Today for a very long time, and I've always found them to be very moderate. They're liberal on certain things. But misinformation has never been defined. I mean, we've been through all of this before. Covert efforts have never been defined. This has already been destroyed. Now we're going on 10 years now. And so this is simply a means of intimidation. Misinformation isn't defined and is not a crime. Although things like hate speech are not defined in places like Britain, and yet that is still being used to drag people in front of judges. Now, I was a little disappointed in RT's response. They needed to have contacted me for this. Their response was meant to be sarcastic and funny. They have 7 lines. The first is ha. The second is ha 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 ha. The third is a much louder ha 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 ha. The fourth is 2016 called and it wants its cliches back. The fifth is 3 things are certain in life: death, taxes, and RT's interference in the U.S. elections. 6 is, well, we got to earn our Kremlin paycheck somehow. And 7 is, somewhere Hillary Clinton is sad that it's not because of her. Sincerely, the RT press office. That's okay. They could have done, there's so much to parody here. But that's about the most you can do to give any credence to this whatsoever is to respond like that. Everybody, including the people who are setting this up, know that it's ridiculous. And in fact, know that the regime itself has interfered in elections all over the planet and continues to do so. And so there's no question in this particular case that they know that this is nonsense. You may remember that RT and Sputnik in particular are banned in the European Union, but that would also include Britain too. And that's really the same foundation has been used for that banning, starting from the beginning of the war. Now, every once in a while, someone in this unelected Biden administration will accuse Russia of meddling in the 2020 campaign, which is a little strange. But the intelligence agencies, and of course, they never released a whole lot of information. I read the 500-page report a few years ago that came out of Mueller's office, which said very little. But in this case, the repeated claim is that hackers are being deployed. Now, they said this in 2016 and 2020, although very little of that showed up in the report. It was mostly their concern with propaganda, that they can't control the narrative entirely, although they can almost entirely. They also never explain why Moscow would want Donald Trump in office. He was just as harsh on Moscow as anyone else. And Donald Trump is vehemently opposed to Russian concerns, say, in the Middle East. You know, he is he's as much of a Zionist as anybody else. So they never answer that very simple question. Now, it is true that on occasion they talk about these Guccifers and these nonsensical hacking things. But if you remember, it was John McAfee, the late John McAfee, who explained in great detail how this was utter nonsense, that they have the capacity to, in the computerized world, the digital world, to hack into various systems, but they don't have the capacity to cover their tracks. McAfee's argument, of course, was that there's no way that anyone of this skill, and you know, he's the one, he created and programmed the whole architecture of the antiviral software years and years ago. But there was no way that they would ever allow their tracks to be discovered. That's what doesn't show up in the various reports. So in this case, despite their occasional concern with hacking, I think what they mean by hacking has more to do with spreading what they call disinformation. That is to say, truth and logic. And of course, those of you who have read back, 2019, where all of these charges have, and the charges, they're not legal charges. Disinformation is not a legal charge. But these were all found to be baseless years ago. If you remember, it was 4 years ago. You had these faceless 50 former intelligence officials published a letter that claimed that the files on Hunter Biden's laptop, and we all know about these corruption schemes, I don't have to get into them, were fabricated by the GRU. Of course, they were absolutely 100% genuine, and no one makes that claim anymore. In 2017, the Department of Justice forced RT to register as a foreign agent, but of course, none of the Zionist institutions, who actually are foreign agents, ever had to be concerned with this. But what they defined as hacking back then, and they're doing the exact same thing right now, is by claiming that, hacking is the same as negative coverage of either Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, or whoever. They even said that criticism of the American corrupt political establishment was part of their definition of hacking and misinformation. Now, there was such a thing as RT America, and they were forced by the state out because U.S. distributors dumped them because of the war, and that was in 2022. But this is very typical. This is perfectly consistent with liberalism and liberal democracy. But supporting what they knew then and know now to be lies is nothing new. It was in June, I believe, that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence made the claim that the Kremlin, and nothing more detailed than that, had mounted what they called a whole-of-government effort to turn the American public against Biden and his fellow Democrats. Of course, that was prior to his bowing out of the race. But it isn't as if in the past, and this was, 2019 is when this was finally put to rest by the court in Washington, D.C. But that court, and in that decision, which I had to refresh my memory on, but the judge in that case, and I'm quoting him directly here, that the Attorney General's public statements improperly suggested a link between the defendants, they're talking about a Russian group, and the Russian government, and assumed the opinion about the defendant's guilt and the evidence against them. In other words, they simply made claims that were not in evidence as a matter of propaganda, not a matter of legality. And, they were up for contempt hearing as a result. And, of course, that went nowhere. That the assumption for the sake of media manipulation was that there was guilt. This was a whole of government. I've never heard the phrase whole of government before, meaning that the entire Russian state in Moscow was behind this. And ultimately, the court called Mueller and his friends disingenuous. They were brought up on contempt charges because you can't promote this idea of obvious guilt as if the case has already been decided. And you know the implications of this. This accusation, as RT itself says, paved the way for the raid on the house of Scott Ritter. And I had all forgotten about Dmitry Seimas, who was born in the Soviet Union, who became an English language pundit. And he hosts shows on both sides of the Atlantic. And Ritter, who I've quoted many times on this very program, said that this was an attempt to intimidate anyone, in his own words, who goes against official policies, and particularly against the deep state. The Russian ambassador, Anatoly Antonov, condemned this whole thing. He called it a political inquisition, et cetera, specifically about the sacking of the home of Seimas in Virginia, who, of course, has been a critic of this present administration. Pretty much everyone's a critic of this present administration. And Seimas was on Channel 1 in Russia since 2018. But since he has a house in America, he was considered fair game. But saying things like the hundreds of people are undesirable because they dare contradict policies of the regime, the deep state, or this administration, that's an understatement. Breaking into homes, performing searches, seizing documents. The ambassador did make a stupid statement that this is like Joe McCarthy, though Joe McCarthy did nothing of the kind, didn't have the power to do anything like this. And in fact, the reverse would be true. Those supporting Joe McCarthy are actually treated like they claim, and again, another form of projection, that Joe McCarthy treated others. And they just assume that a senator is in a chief executive and law enforcement position. But what we're looking at is the apogee, the zenith of Western liberalism, that is, total censorship. That freedom of speech only refers to things that the regime finds congenial. Especially when it comes to the obsessive war against Russia. And it doesn't matter in whose favor that war is. It's certainly not in Ukraine's interest. But again, the Russian foreign ministry has always been pretty good on American witch hunts against anyone who's not a leftist. The U.S. lectures the world on this kind of thing. Seimas actually is a U.S. citizen, despite him working in Russia quite often. And he immigrated in 1973. He was an aide to Richard Nixon. So Seamus was also investigated by Robert Mueller as an alleged contact between Trump and the Russian government. A lot of us have kind of forgotten that name in the interim. But again, the courts, among others, have found zero connection there. But they showed up in his home in Virginia, I think about a week after Scott Ritter's home was also raided. There's only one reason for all of this, and that was just because of what they're saying. Now, there's more, of course, to this story. And the next topic I want to get into here is really what's at the core of some of these actions. And that's the role of the Rothschild family in Kyiv's debt. Some of you have been reading about the debt restructuring negotiations that have been going on between the Rothschild family and the American administration in Kyiv, starting on the 1st of September, although this has been going on for some time. The way that RT put it, and I don't know if I'd put it this way, but the government in Kyiv appointed the Rothschild entity as part of its own finance ministry back in 2017. I reported on that at the time, but again, that's nothing new as far as anything like this is concerned. The same thing occurred in Kosovo and in Albania. Now, it wasn't that long ago that Kyiv said that they had reached an agreement in terms of debt restructuring, at least of that part of its debt, that $20 billion that gets in the headlines. It's much higher than that, of course. But that's the kind that has the highest interest rate. Now, there's a bondholders committee over that, representing about maybe 30% of those bonds. And they were willing, as I predicted many years ago, they're willing to take losses. They're willing to take loss of almost $10 billion, the nominal value, on the nominal value of that debt, that is to say, without taking interest into account. The IMF apparently agreed to this, saying that it's perfectly compatible with its $122 billion aid package to Kyiv. But any relief or any repayment having anything to do with the Kievan government is actually being financed by taxpayers and those who pay interest to any bank, which is almost everybody. The IMF has signed off on this, the Paris Club, the Rothschilds, and there was something published on the London Stock Exchange that went into detail with all of this. Well, the point is that U.S. taxpayers are going to be helping to pay this debt. I think the estimate is about $11 billion is going to be saved in interest payments on the grounds that this is crucial to the war effort. Showing the level of fanaticism and the willingness of the regime to lose a huge amount of money. Now, of course, I've been saying this for two decades. The IMF, any of the major banks, when they forward a loan to Ukraine from the 2000s onward, they're never going to see this again. They know they're losing it. But these very people who are forwarding this money are the same that decide what money is and where it comes from. But this was done so quickly, it shows the power of the Rothschilds, and BlackRock, of course, is a part of all of this, over what's considered debt, what's considered money all over the world. Now, back in 2022, talks broke down because Kyiv was demanding, there's actually an entire NGO out there. I think it's called Cancel Ukraine's Debt. In other words, that Ukraine should be bailed out even more so by the American taxpayer, who ultimately backs all of this, is forced to back all of this. But talks broke down because the Rothschilds said that what Kyiv or what the U.S. was demanding, U.S. government was demanding, was excessive. And that this is going to do damage. This is a, very briefly, was a schism between the regime on the one hand and the state on the other. This was very quickly healed, though. It's one of these things where governments and the regime can sometimes disagree. Governments are only a piece of the regime. They're a strong piece of it, but they're only a piece of it. But the Rothschilds reconvened their offices in Paris, and that's when they brought in all of the top asset management firms, because everyone's involved in on this. The Rothschilds went up against the head of the debt financer financing committee in Kiev, which was Yuri Butsa. So this is one of the many reasons that Zelensky, when he goes off, when he loses his temper, he's going against his own people. Sometimes he believes his own propaganda. The IMF said that they were willing, the consortium of these banks were willing to take huge losses. Now, what Kiev offered and what was basically accepted was they wanted a loan based on GDP growth. And this is what was, I think, got like 90% support, at least according to Reuters, amongst the bondholders, was that debt repayment is, by this very contract, connected to whether or not Ukraine's economy actually recovers. It's, if it doesn't, it's 1.75%. If it does, it's almost 8%. And this isn't just that $20 billion, which had the highest interest rate attached to it. But to say that this is somehow about Kiev, their credit rating, which, you know, the credit rating agencies are highly politicized, it doesn't make any difference. Because the regime is forwarding money that they're never going to see again. They have been doing this to Kiev in for a very long time. This is just a temporary measure, so it doesn't have to pay these interest rates. At least there'd be $10 to $15 billion in interest. But any penny that comes out of Kiev is from the taxpayer to begin with, from the American taxpayer to begin with. There's zero tax base in the country. And things that actually are counted as Ukrainian GDP are in the East, not under its control, or even Crimea. So they're thinking something like $23 billion up until 2033, which is what the prime minister in Ukraine, who we always forget about, Denis Shmigal, he made this claim. And therefore, that's going to free up resources for defense. This is shadowboxing. This is utter nonsense. Because this all comes from assistance from the American taxpayer. This is just as a matter of a timetable for repayment. Since, you know, whatever happens here in the future, at least the western part of the country is going to remain under some western control. Any restructuring there is already been contractually obligated to the BlackRock cult anyway. They don't talk about the assets that they're going to lose in the East. They don't talk about assets that they've lost long ago in the East. The entire purpose of both the 2004 and 2014 revolutions was to make sure that you have a friendly government that could strip whatever's left of the assets, state-owned and otherwise, in the parts of Ukraine under Kiev's control. That's exactly why the war erupted in 2014, not just in 2022. The point of it is that Kiev exclusively, its entire functionality is based on foreign aid. It's no different than Somalia. It's government apparatus to the extent it functions at all is financed entirely by Western aid, by the especially the American taxpayer. Kiev is almost entirely dependent on foreign aid. To talk about things like default or debt repayment or interest rates or bond ratings, this is theater. because whatever it pays is already coming from Western Aid. It doesn't have the ability to finance its own budget. Talking about whether it's going to default or not, and this default allegedly was suspended because of the $61 billion aid package finally authorized in April. Talking about, I mean, you know, for Argentina to talk about debt restructuring, that's one thing. But for a place like Kosovo, or the former government in Afghanistan prior to the Taliban takeover, or the government in Kiev, that's a completely different thing. These are already Western-subsidized establishments. It's almost like this is to create the impression that Kiev has some independence in all of this. So this nonsense about interest rate changes, well, as far as Ukraine as a political and economic entity is concerned, they don't have the capacity to pay any of it. That's nothing new. They could talk about the GDP-linked interest rates, the capital payment starting in 2029 at 8%, 23% of the outstanding claim. All of these numbers mean absolutely nothing, partially because a lot of these only kick in if Ukraine's economy outperforms IMF expectations. Defaulting on its debt, well, Ukraine's been in bankruptcy and default for two decades. So these are, you know, the old metaphor about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic is what this is really all about. I don't know if they're simply laying this contractual groundwork, because even contracts don't make any difference in this case. We're not talking about the functioning of a government here. To the extent that we could trust any official estimates of Ukraine's GDP, however they're going to define that and what borders they're going to use, the debt is far higher than any of these estimates. Talking about the Ukraine has a month to avoid default is just a nonsensical, you know, it's academic in the worst sense of the phrase. These people are never going to see their money again. If anything, all of these technicalities are about what the American taxpayer is going to have to pay. Now, off the top of my head, I couldn't find who finances this cancel Ukraine's debt thing. But if the regime, on the one hand, is going to try to steal this $300 billion from Russia in violation of every possible contract, then what they agree on with any of this has no meaning either, because there is no contract law as far as this goes. The Kievan regime, there is no functional economy. There is no functional military. These are all Western creations. Some are pure illusion, and some aren't. But even claiming that there's a Russian delegation at the IMF that voted against the plan is equally nonsense. Everyone knows that Ukraine's finances are catastrophic, but they have been for a very long time. I think it was The Economist, which is, by the way, a Rothschild outlet. They said, if in 2025 Western banks refuse to write off Kiev's debts, including the debts of private companies and banks, the country could face bankruptcy. I don't know who they're talking to here. Ukraine has been in bankruptcy for many, many years. The risks of cooperating with this government on any level are extremely high. Everyone is going to lose money, at least how they define the term. This all is being financed by Western taxpayers and Western consumers. Everything, their entire budget is being paid by the American taxpayer. So finally, the former Ukrainian Prime Minister, Azarov, said that the economic crisis in Ukraine began many, many years ago. Bankruptcy. It's always been bankrupt. There is no budget. There is no military. There's nothing over there that's not financed by the West. It's the same people on both sides of the divide, in other words. But at least on paper, interest rate payments are the highest aspect of this Kievan budget. Back in 2022, BlackRock and PIMCO gave a 2-year debt holiday to Kyiv. Now that's largely run out. But even if all of this actually matters, don't forget, Zelensky's term as president ran out in May. So what sort of power he has, if you want to be legal about it, is a whole completely separate issue. So when I read about these debt negotiations, the Rothschilds and BlackRock, I don't really know what they're talking about. It's not like negotiating something with your bank or the electric company. It doesn't work that way. There is no functionality on Kyiv's side. It is a colony, although not in a legal way. Although I have to say that the IMF has been pretty good and say this $300 billion, which apparently still hasn't been taken, which suggests that this may be an illusion as well. The IMF is opposed to this. So there's a connection between the financial aspects and the aspects of censorship, both in Ukraine and in the U.S. And in the midst of all this, just a few days ago, Zelensky, I don't know if this is at American orders or not, engaged in yet another purge of senior officials. They're going to run out of people. There's only a handful of people who want to serve this government anyway. The deputy prime minister has been forced out. The head of his own office, Radoslav Sharma, was fired. And even though it's on their website, it doesn't give any reason whatsoever. The Speaker of Ukraine's Parliament, Stefanchuk, the Minister for European Integration, Strategic Industries, which you talk about a useless position, the Minister of Justice, Minister of Environmental Protection, like that makes any difference, all of them handed in resignation letters. Again, Zelensky's standing is odd because his power ran out in May. So even in that sense, talking about contracts or constitutionality or legality don't make any sense at all. Most of you know about Zaluzhny, Valery Zaluzhny, the head of the supreme commander of Ukraine's armed forces, fired, although it's assumed that it's because of the 200,000 men lost last summer. A year ago, last September, Alexei Reznikov, the defense minister, was fired over the failures in Kharkov. The Washington Post says nothing of value. They said that these people that have been sacked are reformists, men who appeared especially close to Washington. Well, they're all especially close to Washington. The claim is that all of this occurs only when you have particularly nasty losses on the battlefield, but that would be constant purges in that case. We talked about the Kursk cross-border raid, which the only thing that did is allow Russia to advance farther in its own Donbas area. As of right now, the casualties are about 10,000 men, either POWs or killed or maimed or just put out of action in one way or another, and almost 1,000 armored vehicles. And remember, yes, it does come from the Russian Defense Ministry, but that can only be based on confirmed kills, not kills that can't be confirmed, although that can get registered later. So these are probably low estimates. That means there's very little of that mercenary force left. And what ends up happening is that these forces being removed, they're not being reinforced, they don't have supplies, they're completely cut off. What was the point of all this, except, as I said before, as nothing but propaganda? You add to this what happened with the F-16, which is really, again, this whole thing is very sad, whether we talk about the economics, the fiscal issues, or the military issues. There's nothing funny about any of this. The head of the Air Force, what's left of it, the Ukrainian Air Force, that's like the Navy of Kazakhstan. It's a landlocked country. So the head of the Air Force that barely exists was removed. Nikolai Oleshchuk. Because one of the few F-16s that they were able to put into the air either was crashed or shot down, depending on who you read. It wasn't that long ago. Its pilot was Alexei Mesh. Kyiv refused to admit the loss until just, it wasn't really that long ago. claiming that it's under investigation. There was one member of parliament, Mariana Bizuglia, who said that, yeah, he was shot down. He was shot down by an American Patriot air defense system missile. Oleschuk screamed and yelled at her in public, which suggests a typical of what's happening in the Capitol. But the fact that Bizuglia said this at all, Oleschuk lost his temper, saying that he was a tool of Kremlin propaganda yet again. He said, a tool to discredit the top military leadership. You not only poured dirt on me personally and on the Air Force, you discredited the manufacturers of American weapons, the main ally of Ukraine, the USA. A very odd accusation to make. How awful it is to discredit the manufacturer of American weapons. Of course, what she's saying is absolutely true. She's not exactly an opposition politician. There is no such thing in Kiev. But it was after that outburst that Oleschuk was fired. It didn't have anything to do with the outburst, of course, except that the RADA member was right. No specific reason was given, but the fact that the presidential office said he was fired to protect the lives of our servicemen. And this was seconded by Sersky, the supreme commander of the Ukrainian armed forces, suggesting, of course, that what she said is absolutely true. Initially, you know, Kiev said nothing. Then they denied it. Then they said that it was an accident. Then, of course, they finally admitted that it was a friendly fire. What Bizuglia said that got the commander of the Air Force so upset, she said, but a culture of lies leads to a management system for military decisions that does not improve based on truthful, consistently collected analytics, but worsens and even collapses, as seen in the Pokrovsk direction, or vector. And she's making reference, of course, to Russia's advance towards this logistically important but otherwise minor city in Donbass. The Pentagon was asked about this. Of course, this is all, just like all the fiscal stuff, is all theater. The idiot spokesman, Sabrina Singh, said, well, this we don't know. This is up to the Ukrainians to address, as if the U.S. wouldn't know this. Kiev also tried to say that, well, the pilot just lost control. I'm not sure which is worse. I mean, we've been talking about the lack of training for these guys. The fact of the lack of fuel, the lack of spare parts, the lack of everything concerning these advanced weapons. Kiev doesn't have any of it. That stupid response from the Pentagon suggests, of course, that Bizuglia was absolutely right. Or else they would have denied it openly. Now, the U.S. doesn't sell F-16s or give them, but other NATO members do. Allegedly, they've promised 80, but there have been only a couple dozen that have been delivered, and almost all of them, if not all of them, has been destroyed. There was a Russian company that offered 15 million rubles, whoever shoots down the first F-16 in combat. But no one has claimed this so far because it was an American missile. I'm not sure which is worse, to say that the guy lost control and therefore training is bad, or that it was friendly fire. It pretty much says the same thing. And Bizuglia, you know, essentially admitted that. There's an investigation on this, but the loss of this F-16 is emblematic of everything that we've talked about so far. It's emblematic of the empire. It's emblematic of the regime. It's emblematic of the fiscal situation in Kiev. It's emblematic of the media narrative. And this poor guy, Alexei Mish, one of a handful trained to fly the F-16, of course, is killed. Should have been flying for the Russian Air Force. But he's just one of God knows how many who have been unnecessarily killed in this war. Just like the fiscal issue, the so-called debt restructuring nonsense. Represents equally the millions who have been driven into poverty in Ukraine, a well-educated, very civilized Christian population driven into poverty, emigration, and of course now death, somehow to repay this debt that the West knows they're never going to be able to see. They're going to be made whole somehow. But this is what the regime has driven this country to do. This F-16 loss and the humiliation of the Air Force and everybody else over there, it is emblematic of everything else that this war represents. So much of it is illusion. So much of it is lies. But with all that, I thank you everyone for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.